I just want to say officially welcome to Linda Buckley Archer, who's a very dear friend of mine and a valued writing colleague. Linda is author of The Gideon Trilogy, which is an exciting mix of adventure, science fiction and history. Linda was born in Sussex and spent much of her childhood in rural Staffordshire before settling in London, where she now lives with her husband and two lovely children. Originally trained as a linguist, Linda lectured in French for some years before becoming a full-time novelist and scriptwriter. Linda has recently completed the final book, The Time Quake, of the Gideon Trilogy of novels for older children, inspired by the criminal underworld of 18th century London. And as I know, she's currently hard at work on an exciting new project. The first two books in the Gideon Trilogy, The Time Travellers and Time Thief, are also widely available internationally. So, Linda, welcome.
Thank you. What a fulsome introduction.
It's lovely for me to actually sort of review your career like that, actually. I think possibly the best place to begin is, could you just tell us a little bit about your published work and the focus of your work to date?
Sure. I didn't actually start writing novels. It kind of happened by accident, but we can talk a bit more about that later. But I suppose as a published novelist, I have written the three novels of the Gideon trilogy, and I think as sometimes happens with novels, I wasn't quite sure where I was going with it right at the beginning. I wrote it for my son Louis, who at that point was about 9, and he wasn't a great reader, he read, but not the kind of things that I wanted him to read. So he's written lots of comics and fishing magazines, which he still does all these years later. I was actually doing sort of script writing and bits of journalism at the time, but I started to write this novel, and I used to read it to them after Sunday dinner, which was, in retrospect, actually a terrifically good way of learning how to write for children, because if they get bored, they start fidgeting, and if you write something that they like, you know, they'll sort of gasp and say, oh, Mum, you can't do that, or what have you. So it was kind of very good for, you know, my boredom and Penny, or what have you. I suppose about 2 or 3 years, I was trying to get an agent for my scripts, and she basically said, I love your writing, your scripts, let's keep in touch, but you're not earning enough as a script writer to warrant my fee, sort of thing, but have you got anything else to show me? Mm-hmm. And so I said, well, there is this children's book that I'd been writing for my son, and she took a look at it, which was very good of it, because she was a script agent, not an agent specialised in novels, and she got very excited, and then the trilogy was sold very quickly all over the place, and then I was kind of locked into becoming a novelist. So that was just one side of it. I kind of didn't originally see myself as a novelist, but I kind of thought this was going to be a sideline, and for the past 5 years it's been a full-time career and very full-on. And I have to say it's been wonderful for me to have had the opportunity to develop this thing, this huge, gigantic thing, thousands of pages, and to kind of introduce what it is. I wanted something that was quite exciting for my children to listen to, and I decided, I asked about how I got the idea later, but basically it's set in the 18th century very much. At least the first volume is set, at least three quarters of it, in 1763, and it's very much about criminals, and it is about two 21st century children to get catapulted back in time, and it's very much their view of the 18th century. They get in all sorts of adventures. There's two main characters, my protagonist and antagonist, both of whom are criminals. One's a reformed one, one's certainly not a reformed criminal, and enjoys it a lot. And this second criminal, the tarman, the eponymous tarman, is the subject of book two. He manages to get into 21st century London. So the second book is our time viewed through the eyes of an 18th century criminal. And he basically runs rings around the police and becomes very rich and does all sorts of things. And book three, which is now out, it's been out for about 6-7 months in the UK, that one is quite apocalyptic. And maybe I shouldn't say too much about that in case anybody wants to read it, but that kind of finishes it all off. And that was terrific fun to write, and part of the plot was set in the States and was to do with the American War of Independence and General Washington and all sorts of things. But it's a mix of 21st century and 18th century, and I suppose the themes are very much to do with sort of love and loss and family and... hopefully there's some good adventures in between too.
I mean, what's exciting for me, Linda, when I listen to that trajectory of how the novels have grown up from you sitting around the kitchen table sort of reading it to your children after Sunday dinner to this incredibly complex tale that crosses the centuries. There's a couple of questions that immediately come to mind, and I think the first one is when you were reading that story to your children at Sunday dinner, did it seem possible to you, did you envisage the place where you are now with
it? In terms of did I envisage that it would even be published, not really, being slightly pessimistic by nature. I very much felt that it was a training. I was training myself to write a novel. In fact, I didn't even call it a novel for a while. I just thought, this is my story. And it was only when it got into, I don't know, 60 or 70,000 words, I thought, no, actually, this is a novel, isn't it? But curiously, looking back on it, I can distinctly remember the afternoon when I heard something that inspired me, which was a historian. I just happened to be in the car, and the historian started to talk about the kinds of criminals they had in 18th century London. And it was one of those kind of like love at first sight moments, but, you know, I think a lot of novelists have, you just know. Mm. You know, you just know so surely this, I want to write about this. And I must have really wanted to write about it because, you know, it was years in the making. Yeah. And it's rather bizarre to me now that I can have been quite so sure. I mean, what a commitment. I mean, if I'd have known then, you know, somebody could have said, if you start on this, you're going to be doing this for 8 or 9 years. You know, I think I would have run away in terror. But I thought it was going to be, you know, take quite some writing, but I knew from the start that it was going to be a trilogy. I did think right from the beginning, I need somebody in the 21st century going back to the 18th century, and then the middle volume, sort of the opposite, and then I need to tie it up. And I had a very vague kind of storyline, but I mean, that was within the first half hour. Wow. of listening to this woman talking about anglers, you know, those criminals who'd lie on their bellies on top of carriages in Covent Garden, pinching people's wigs. I just got it, you know, it's very visual, and I got Giddy in the main character almost straight away. So did I envisage where I, you know, where, certainly where I am now, no way did I sort of think that I'd get an agent to be published or anything. But I did think this could be a very big story.
Yeah. Well, that, I mean, it sounds the way you, absolutely, and it sounds the way you describe it as well, almost just like one of those moments of absolute inspiration where everything comes together, your own sort of,
yeah,
just that spark of the idea, but also your passion coming together with that, which is obviously what sustained you through that long,
yes,
process as,
yeah,
well. Yeah. So what was,
and
the
naivety as well. I mean, I have to say, I doubt whether I will get quite such a moment ever again, because, you know, now I know what it all entails. And, you know, I think a slight case of beginner's luck as well. You know, there were no negatives sort of presenting themselves saying, you can't do that. I think they might do now.
And yeah, it's interesting because I remember that, and I remember your, you know, enthusiasm and passion for the project that I think has never, from what I've seen as a sort of observer of you and your work, has never faltered. And
no,
yet at the same time, sort of thinking about, I know that people listening will be interested in that whole process about getting an agent and how, you know, in some ways when one looks at the trajectory, it sounds easy. And yet, of course, presumably there were, what, 2 or 3 years where you were simply writing this before you even got to that stage of approaching an agent?
Absolutely. I mean, I didn't approach an agent until I was, I think, amazingly 5 years in.
Wow.
And I was so, presumably.
You know, tell me what was going on in your writing life apart from Gideon, because if I remember rightly, there were several strands of work.
Oh, yes.
At the time.
I think that when, I'd studied literature, you know, at French literature for first degree, and then I did an MA in 20th century French literature, and so I was kind of very keen, shall we say, on literature, but never really dared do any writing myself. I used to fill sort of exercise books of just a single paragraph and read them and think, this just isn't good enough. So I'd kind of leave it at one paragraph and then stop. So I remember my breakthrough moment actually was I did a short course in journalism, and in fact, of course, as you, for people listening, my big first success actually was interviewing Jackie Loftus and having it was fantastic. I have to say, in retrospect, this moment when, because you were laughing because you know the story, I should say, I did a journalist course, and then I decided that being a novelist was never going to pay. It wasn't at all sensible, and I would like to do it one day, but I better do the right thing and learn how to make my living. So I thought journalism sounded like a good idea, and then I thought, again naively, script writing sounded like a good idea too. And who should teach me script writing but this lady called Jackie Loftus, who'd recently got a novel published.
Mm-hmm.
And so I very bravely at the time approached Jackie and said I'd like to have a go at doing an interview and kind of selling it to a newspaper to see if I could do it, you know, to get an article under my belt. And to my absolute delight, shortly after, it was a pretty throat morning, wasn't
and
it?
And to my and, absolute delight
and,
as well
and,
at the time, of course.
Boyd Tonkin at the Independent, he rang me up after I'd sent it to him and said, yes, this sounds very interesting, and commissioned the article. So
it did, I suppose, a lot of good, actually, didn't it, effectively? I think it was a win-win situation, I think.
It was. It was, and of course he got a jolly good article about it. Very interesting, I'm afraid. But anyway, it was, looking back on it, though, that phone call It was validation. It was you can write well enough for somebody to want to publish it. Mm. And I think I felt more joyful actually at that very moment when Boyd Duncan commissioned that first article. Probably easily as much actually as when I heard about the publishing deal, looking back on it. I did, because I think until you do get published, you live in hope and you must believe in yourself to carry on. But you do, sadly in a way, but I think you do kind of need some external person to say you're good enough for us to want your work, to pay for it. If you get paid for your writing, that's a kind of, that does mean a lot.
But that's interesting from the point of view of, I think just the steps in our writing career as well, that, you know, that we don't necessarily have to publish the big book as the first thing we do.
Oh, heaven
that any
grand.
Sort of kind of external validation is a really positive thing.
And I have to say that we can maybe talk about this later, but when publishers bought the first book, Gideon the Cuphead, of course, they wanted books 2 and 3, and actually the pressure to produce another couple of novels in a very—I mean, they wanted them really in 2 years, you know, one novel a year. I remember sort of my agent and I were kind of looking at each other and thinking, "Oh my goodness, that's a bit tight." And in the end, we sort of negotiated a year and a half. Mm-hmm. No, actually it was 15 months, but they didn't get it 15 months. but that was hard. That was hard. And it's actually quite nice, I think, to be able to learn your craft kind of at your own pace. And you certainly don't need, to be published to do that. I mean,
I think that's actually a really important point for those people listening, actually, to actually be aware of the really positive part of, some people in listening will have published, of course, but for those who haven't published yet, the really positive part of not being in contract is the creative freedom that you have, presumably.
Yeah, I heard Philip Pullman, who's a favourite novelist of mine, saying a couple of years ago at a conference that, in very many ways he's nostalgic for those years when he was teaching and writing in the evening, because sure, he only had 2 or 3 hours each evening, but he knew where he was and he just got down to it and he enjoyed it. And now his day is so full of phone calls and, stuff to do with writing, and of course all the pressures on you. So I know it's easy to say, but actually those times when you are just learning how to write are incredibly precious and valuable, and not to be wished away too soon.
Yeah.
And I have to say that when I was writing Gideon, the first novel, I was aware of that actually, and I can remember, because Jack and I we workshop our writing with other novelists, and I'd seen Jackie being published and various other people in the group being published, and I could see it wasn't it's not all roses, is it?
There's
pressures.
Yeah, I think that's true, and I think it's also very easy kind of prior to being published to thinking that kind of publication is the sort of the Holy Grail, or something that's kind of impossible. And yet we both have been authors who wanted to be published and saw it as kind of impossible, and yet it's happened, and we've seen others of our friends go through that process, only to discover that there are actually new challenges, shall we say, once you're through that hurdle.
Yes.
you know, and also the way in which careers are very up and down, and publication itself isn't a guarantee of, you know, success forevermore. We've seen friends of ours have careers that have gone up and down and been in publication and out of publication, which kind of, I'm sort of jumping the gun, actually, because I do want to talk to you about how you work and structuring your work and research. But I think as we're on the subject of writing groups, and I know that's something that people are interested to hear about, and we've begun to touch on that, I wonder how, you know, what role, I suppose, being a member of a writing group has had on your work. I mean, what are the positives, and if there are negatives as well, you know, what does having writing colleagues mean for you?
I think, looking back on it, I think, well, it's difficult to imagine how would it have been had I not, because it was there. I know for sure that I, like many, many other writers, have started my writing career by going to writing classes, and it's so valuable to be in a room with other people who want to write and be given, well, kind of mini deadlines. You know, you are going to read a short story out next week, or, you know, in our case, you know, we turn up for a session and everybody reads their little bit, and you want it to be good, and you know when it's gone well, and you know jolly well when it hasn't, and that feedback is invaluable. But it's just as well the feeling of not being isolated too, and I think the other, certainly the other rationale behind going so faithfully to our writing group for so many years now is you get involved in other people's careers and you know, that kind of companionship. And also, I suppose, just being able to see it is possible to be published. You see other people who maybe like your work, and they're being published, so you begin to think it's possible. Mm, I think that's maybe part of it as well.
And I think you're right, that sense of the kind of being accountable to other people and just having those kind of deadlines. I think, as you say, writers often feel so isolated that actually, without that, you know, that I know many people listening to this are part of my group, the Completion Club, and that sort of camaraderie, I think, has, you know, I'm already seeing how that's working for people in the group as well.
And just practical knowledge as well. I don't think I would have had a clue about how to go about getting an agent and all that sort of thing, or how publishing works, or how, you know, about how important it is to get your book on a table in Waterstones in order for it to sell, and all this kind of, you know, quite practical stuff that is perfectly simple when somebody explains it to you, but you just don't know at the start. So, yeah.
Well, thanks for that, Linda. And let's talk a bit about your processes as well, because, again, I'm looking to hear about that. I mean, a conversation I so often have with clients of mine who I work with coaching is the whole area and the ongoing discussion about structure in our work, and this kind of this big question which comes back again and again: do you work organically with just a germ of an idea and grow it naturally from there, not quite knowing where it goes, or do you structure the whole thing in advance? And I know that you, as a with a script writing background, I'm sure you have some strong views on this.
Well, I don't know about strong, but I can. But certainly, it has affected my novel writing hugely, having started off in script writing. And I should say that while I was writing Gideon the Cutthroat, the first novel of the trilogy, which took I suppose 5 years from beginning to end. Though I did rewrite the first third of it about at least 10 times, trying to get it right. not that it's perfect, but it was certainly better than it was. But while I was doing all of that, I was doing radio drama and a little bit of TV drama. And in truth, I was just beginning to think I was making some headway in getting scripts commissioned when I was published. I got this publishing contract, so that kind of stopped. But it did mean that all the time that I was writing Gideon, I was trying very hard to write the best scripts that I could, and I was going to courses and I was reading lots of books, you know, like Rob McKee's Story and Philip Parker's The Art and the Science of Screenwriting and Linda Sager on Character and Structure and so on. And it was pretty ingrained in my head that this is how you wrote. So when I was thinking about the novels, yes, I was thinking in terms of, I suppose, a three-act structure.
Mm-hmm. From the very beginning. Were you thinking about that?
Yeah, I think I was. And I think in hindsight, this trilogy business was very much a beginning, a middle, and an end, you know, the three books. And within each book, the kind of the setup, the confrontation, the resolution, I thought in terms of drama is conflict. So I was very careful to have my protagonist and antagonist, which I thought a lot about. So I have Gideon the cupbearer I didn't want black and white sort of heroes and villains. That was very important to me, but all the same, I needed that. I needed a kind of a quest. I needed a journey, you know, character arcs, all of this business. I can remember being very conscious of, with each chapter, you splitting it into scenes, and each scene I tried to arrive late and leave early, as the cliche goes, mm-hmm. in script writing. I wasn't at all embarrassed about having cliffhangers, which sort of subsequently I've had loads of people saying, I hate you for doing this, you know, getting really, really cross. I mean, not just kind of lovely cross, but very cross with dreadful.
At
the end of the book. people got terribly cross at me for doing, because I did a cliffhanger after book one and book two. But you see, for me, it was one huge story. Of course, for them, they had to wait for 2 years between books. So I can see their point. Though it didn't occur to me while I was writing, it just seemed that this is the right thing to do. You know, you've got to make them want to turn the page. So there was a lot that you could directly attribute to having been trained as a screenwriter first.
Well, I'm interested in that because I know not all writers work that way. It's clearly had a fantastic and a really positive impact on the book, makes it very readable, very kind of a real page turner of a novel, of a trilogy. What kind of interests me is within that quite firm structure that you began to set up for yourself, were there A, creative accidents, and B, things happening that you didn't expect to happen in the process
yes.
of writing?
Oops, sorry, that's my email. yes. And in fact, having just said all of that about script writing, in fact, I should just add that was very much the case with novel one. With novel two, I was, because I had it all planned out, you know, I've still got all the scribbled notes, but it was very planned. All the chapter headings, I knew exactly what was going to go in. And with the Carman book too, I was already beginning to suspect that actually I should give myself a little bit more freedom. Mm-hmm. And by the time it got to book three, now whether this was because of blind fear of deadlines or not, I'm not quite sure, but I went through about 3 months of really being very blocked, and then I thought, I'm just going to have to start writing. And I just started to write, and that was much freer. Though you know, even then, I sort of had a vague plan that I kept not following. But I think maybe that's just to do with sort of your confidence as a novelist as you write more. So having said that, I'm just writing a new one. I feel as ignorant as I do when I start to write Gideon the Cuthbert.
So are you finding your way with
that? I guess that I still do believe in the thought, put it another way, the thought of writing a whole huge novel and then having to rewrite it and restructure it and so on because you got it wrong, because you just, you know, organically start at the beginning and see where you got to. That sort of just unbearable to me because of the way I work. I tend to write a chapter and write it again and again and again until I'm pleased with it and then move on. And psychologically I find it difficult to move on until I've completed that first chapter. And so the thought of you know, just starting and seeing where you end up, it's hard for me. I can't quite cope with, you know, to an extent, but...
Do you think that...
I remember I was very shocked when you said that you did that. I do remember being positively shocked that you said you didn't know what was going to happen in the end. Now I can see that was just, you know, I was so naive. I hadn't written enough and I hadn't met enough novelists, but I do remember being profoundly shocked at that time. Now it seems to me that far more novelists take that approach. And I'm still just not sure.
But you know, it's interesting what you said about the fact that you rewrote the first third of Gideon about 10 times, because actually what I tend to say now is that actually by the time I've written the first third and got the first third right, then I'm starting to know what's going to happen in the end. So I think in some ways my process is echo your own in that sense that I might not know at the beginning, but by the time I've rewritten that first third numerous times to get it right and find the voice, then I'm starting to know where it's going, what's going to be happening in the end, starting to think more about structure at a later stage, but not necessarily at the beginning.
And I think, you know, endings are so important. I mean, we can talk about structure, but we can also talk about endings, and I do think that if you get the ending wrong, even if most of the book has been really good, it is disastrous. So I think you've got to be very, very careful with the ending. And I agree with Ian McEwan when he said, I think, words to the effect that you've got to earn the ending, or the ending's got to earn itself, or I've forgotten that phrase. But in other words, you shouldn't impose the ending on your story.
And it's, people talk about it a lot, don't they, when the ending's wrong in a book. It's what gets talked about. I've certainly heard
certain
books.
Yes, they feel let down if it's...
I mean, the other thing I really want to touch on before we open this up to questions is something that's obviously really important with the fact that you're writing a historical novel is the whole area of research. Whether you felt the need to do all of your research before you actually began writing, or whether the research was an ongoing process that happened at the same time as the writing?
Well, that is a fairly crucial question for anybody involved in writing historical fiction. And I think that it's fraught with dangers, actually, as well. I've even heard one novelist, Graham Swift, who was giving a seminar, and I heard him pretty much saying that he does the research after he's written the novel.
Yes, I've heard something.
And he's not the only one. I've sort of since heard quite a few people say that, and the reason that they say that, which you know, I've certainly got into this situation myself, is that it just gets too interesting and one thing leads to another and suddenly the history is suggesting plot points and you're desperate to get it in. Or you go, you know, for instance, I quite large parts of the Tarmac are set in St. Paul's Cathedral. And the area just around St. Paul's Cathedral, sort of near to Samuel Johnson's house and so on. And I discovered the Sir John Soames Museum and desperately tried to get that in. And, you know, I just wanted to sort of share my enthusiasm of what I was seeing with the invisible reader, you know. And I had to chuck quite a few chapters away because I was being too self-indulgent with regard to historical research.
That's interesting, yeah.
But that said, and you can have some, you know, serendipitous moments as well. For instance, I was very keen on using Kew Gardens, and particularly Kew Palace, that has just been built in the 1760s. And I went along to Kew Gardens and I telephoned one of the curators briefly and was asking questions about Queen Charlotte's Cottage, where there's this sort of an important scene. And she was telling me, she suddenly said, well, you know, there were kangaroos in the garden at that point. Swamped. How can this be? Anyway, there's a whole story about how there was a whole menagerie at that point, and it just so appealed to me that I could have these quite emotional scenes taking place in Queen Charlotte's Cottage with kangaroos jumping up and down. So, there were other things too. I won't sort of bore you with it, but it was it's a mixture, I think, doing research of having to keep a tight rein on it. At the same time as doing it properly and thoroughly, and just occasionally sort of having an eye for, actually, that would work. Yes, I'll use that, if that makes sense.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. And I think one thing I've read Rose Germain say something about, that research has to be transformed imaginatively, in some way by the author, and that it's a mistake to effectively sort of put the research directly onto the page, and that's a mistake that, I suppose, less experienced novelists might make, to actually do their research and then just use it. So it's about filtering that research,
using
what's useful and finding a way in which for it to fit your story.
Yes, and I think it's filtering. I think it's also, you know, this composting down business as well. I think if it kind of just sits in your file long enough and you're kind of looking at it every so often, you will know in the end, in your heart of hearts, whether you should use it or not. And actually, talking about Rose Germain, she said something which I went to hear her speak not so long ago, and I was very relieved to hear that she, by the sound of it, she's as messy as I am with kind of writing down all these valuable pieces of information, so that she doesn't file them properly, so that it means that each time you're looking through your file, you're having to review all those things you thought might be useful, and actually it does come in very handy, this sort of perpetual sort of winnowing through all these sort of creative possibilities. So, I mean, there are no rules, are there? I mean, it just sometimes seems to happen, and I think the most important thing is this kind of will to complete, this will to make a cohesive whole that is pleasing to you. If you analysed it too much, you'd go mad, I think.
I think that's true, actually, and I think you're right that everybody has their own processes and their own ways of doing things, and that it's not about right and wrong. It's about finding a way that works for you, yourself.
Yes.
And that whenever we kind of compare experiences with other writing, with other writers, there's that sense of, oh, as you say, you do it differently.
Yes.
There is no one way.
No, there's absolutely not. No.
Yeah. So just to, I suppose, round off our discussion before we bring in a few questions. I suppose what I am interested to ask you is what advice you might give to a writer who has been taking their work seriously for some time, who has a piece of work that either they feel is nearly ready for publication, getting close to being ready. Do you have a sense of what advice you'd give to that writer who is kind of close and thinking about submission but possibly nervous about that whole process? What would be the most useful advice you could give them?
I think probably two things spring to mind. And one is, I think the most important thing in terms of finding an agent is looking at who represents the authors that you most admire. And if they like the same works that you do, I think that can only be a good thing. So that's my sort of first point, really, is that agents will have different tastes, just as the general reading public. So it makes sense to take care with not just sending out your work to absolutely everybody, but sending it out to somebody who you think, well, maybe they'd like it because, we seem to have, our tastes seem to coincide to some degree. That's one. And the other thing is, and this is a cliche, but I absolutely believe in this one, and it is, you don't get a second chance. Mm. If somebody reads your stuff and it's not really everything that it should be, there is no way that you can send it back to them when you think it's better and they'll read it again. Life is too short for that. It's not going to happen. So my advice is make it the very best that it can be before you send it out.
It's interesting. I think you're absolutely right about that. And people often say, should I send it at an early stage? And yet, I also remember when you sent out an early version of Gideon to an agent, and I wonder whether, I seem to be sent to an agent sort of at three chapters before you'd finished the book, and I wonder, looking back on that experience, how you look back at that experience, whether you'd advise another author to do the same.
Probably not, actually.
I remember you got some kind of quite positive feedback at an early stage. Did that give you encouragement to carry on, or?
Oh, yes, sorry. Yes, I know what you're talking about. Yes, sorry. Sorry, everybody who's listening. We have a shared history, Jackie can remember this.
That thing that I have forgotten.
Yes, that is true. I think I'm probably... Now, how many chapters would it have been? Not that many, really. I think it was probably a little bit more than three chapters, but it was, but it wasn't a lot. It was certainly less than 100 pages. It was probably about 70 or 80 pages.
But it was probably very polished as well, to sort of go along with your sense of it being as good as it can be. It probably, from what I remember, was still very, very polished work.
It was.
Even if the novel wasn't finished.
It was. Because of my way of working, it was. I tend to, by the time I finished the novel, I really don't have to really go back and do much at all to, chapters 2, 3, 4, and 5. They're kind of done. So it would have been polished, but yes, I think that at that point I sent it out to a highly respected agent, a children's agent, and she was very generous because she telephoned me a couple of days later and said that she was interested. I think she was slightly disappointed that it wasn't finished. Mm-hmm. But was very gracious and said, but do, take your time and get back to me. That sort of kept me going, actually, for at least a couple of years, that encouragement. Because, again, it is this validation thing. So having there, I'm giving conflicting advice now, aren't I?
I think it fits in with your sense of it being polished, and I think that's the important thing, really, that you send your absolute best work out into the world, not your work that's a bit rough still. You know, I think that sense of it being as good as it can be from your perspective.
Yeah. I think it's very satisfying from an agent's point of view or a publisher's point of view to have the complete novel so that they can just sit down, if they like it, they can just roar through it and get enthusiastic and so on. But that, you know, the practicalities of this, you know, if you want to get out there and, you know, you psychologically, you need to get feedback, then that's a hard thing to do. But if you're one of those people who's happy just to kind of plug away until you finish the novel and then, you know, perfect it and then send it out, I suppose in an ideal world, that is from a publisher's and an agent's point of view, it's nice to have the complete thing. But it's not always possible to do that, and of course, you know, it's a way of earning one's living as well, and perhaps you would need an advance in order to complete the novel in any case. So I think all these things are possible. It depends on circumstances, doesn't it?
Well, thank you so much for that, Linda, and I've so enjoyed the conversation, and, you know, just kind of a sense of being able to review your career and think about how far, you know, you've come, and just to hear about your processes as well. It certainly got me thinking, and I think now's a good time to open up the line to, I think we do have a couple of callers on the line who might have some questions for you. So if anybody on the line who is on mute at the moment could now unmute by pressing a star and zero on their keypad, and I'm sure Linda would be very happy to answer your questions.
Yes, of course I would.
So do we have anybody on the line who has any questions for Linda?
Good evening, it's Denise.
Oh, hello, Denise.
Hi, Linda and Jackie. You've answered my question, because I wanted to ask about agents and how you slid across. But I found your talk fascinating, because I do have written screenplays and scripts, and I've had a hang-up about it, thinking that you know, it doesn't go together with being a novelist and so on. It's taken me a while to make the transition. And so I was really fascinated to hear what you've said. And I too think in sequences, and it's been very affirming for me.
Oh,
lovely to hear.
I'm kind of a great believer, actually, in crossing media, as it were. I think there's so much that you can, that each can learn from the other. Mm. And I'll tell you something else that I have discovered, is that different media are better, I'll help the writer create in different ways. I don't know whether you've had the same experience, but certainly for me, when I'm writing a novel, I do think that prose fiction is more difficult to infuse novel with a great structure, you know, with a film script or TV script, radio drama, whatever, you've really got to think a lot about how you structure it.
Yes,
and you certainly need to know what happens in the end, don't you? I mean, you can't just sort of start at the beginning and see what, I mean, it's laughable, isn't it? You couldn't do it with a script, but you can do it with a novel. But on the other hand, what I found when trying to write scripts from scratch is with finding a voice for your characters and really getting an in-depth knowledge of your characters, the medium of the script isn't terribly generous to the writer, I don't think. Whereas, you know, when you're writing a novel, you can get inside the characters' heads, you can explore them, you can do things with them, and it's much easier. So, you know, I think that if it were possible, it would be nice to write everything in two media so that you get the best of both worlds and get, you know, a perfectly structured, wonderfully rich narrative.
I was too a mission. I was too over their heads to begin with. And I had to get, Jackie's helped me to get closer and closer to my characters, you know, coming from scripts. and seeing it from above, so to speak, or from the camera's point of view, and you know, that's been a journey, and it's been interesting. We've got there.
I'm dreadful for having to start books. Just at the moment, I think, oh, I'm doing it again. I have to see that first shot. I have to create it in words. And of course, you don't have to do that, but I'm finding it really difficult. I can't let that one go. A novelist friend of mine, Emma Darwin, I was talking to her and she was reminding me how important it is to use all the senses, not just the eye, which of course I know. But you know, that I think that's another pitfall for if you're always thinking visually.
I look forward to getting your books, or starting at the beginning.
They are for children, I have to warn you.
I like
they're crossover novels, Linda.
They're crossover novels, and I like the story set up. Yeah, I'm going to get one. I look forward to it.
Well, thank you.
Thanks, Denise. Is there anybody else on the line who has a question for Linda?
Hi, Linda. Teresa.
Hi, Teresa.
Hi. I wanted to thank you for giving us this insight into your writing process and your writing life. It's been very interesting. I'm an historian of art, an art historian, and so I have a particular interest in the relationship between research and writing, your historical research and writing.
Okay.
And I was curious to know, why in the first place did you want to choose to set it in the 18th century? And then how faithful are you, say, to the period or to the historical facts? I'm thinking of, Jackie put it wonderfully, saying that research has to be transformed imaginatively. And that that danger of being bogged down by all the research.
Well, I think one memory that that's quite dear to me for some reason is my favourite character is my villain, who is called the Tar Man, and so called because he was half hanged and was covered in tar and escaped and all sorts of things. Anyway, he was going to just be in book one, and then he kind of insinuated himself into book two quite early on, and then in the end he's in all the way through. Anyway, I spent a lot of time doing research in London, so I do it in various ways. I try and get the language by, I always had She Stoops to Conquer sort of on my desk, and Boswell's Life of Johnson, so I would kind of read that before I did any dialogue to try and get some of the rhythm of 18th century speech. I didn't try to do it totally accurately for children, but I always tried to use some of the vocabulary that indicated that this was an 18th century character, not a 21st century character, and you know, commanded me a carriage, and you know, all that kind of stuff. So that there was that. And there was a history, so I read a lot of history books just to make sure that I didn't make any major errors with who was king and prime minister and all the rest of it. But the landscape in particular was terribly important to me. So I did spend an awful lot of time walking around London pretending that I was this 18th century villain. So... and this is why when Jackie said, you use your imagination to use your research in the best way. And there was one day I remember when I climbed up to the very top of St. Paul's Cathedral when something bad happens to the Tar Man. And he commits a couple of crimes as well. And I remember several things occurred to me while I was sort of tracing his footsteps, going up these stone spiral staircases. And actually, I remember walking behind various old women with pearl necklaces, and sort of eyeing them as he would and thinking, yes, yeah, she'd be good. Yeah, I could. Yeah, and she's got an emerald ring. That would be easy to grab hold of. And so, and seeing the dome, which was magnificent, and seeing the details. And I remember there was something that actually found its way into the book. There was a carving in the wall, and it was a name, and the date was, I think, 1723, which was like 40 years before the tall man would have been around. And and I remember just all these things synthesizing in my head, imagining that I was this criminal, and at the same time with a huge notepad full of dates and names and politicians and things that were happening in 1763. And it began to seem real to me. So that's just one aspect of writing a historical novel. But I really enjoyed that moment.
Well, that's very interesting. Yeah. Because it's I can imagine once you start, well, at least obviously since I'm a historian, once you get into the period, you just keep on doing more and more and more research. And so at some point you have to put it aside. But I think as you're explaining, when you go through, when you sort of recreate the way that they're living and you try to think as an 18th century person would, or you're in your case, the villain.
One thing that did occur when writing the trilogy, which was strange in retrospect, is that I thought that I would have to do more research for the first book when the children went to 1763, and so that I would be reporting or seeing 1763 through their eyes, that it was going to that was going to be the toughest one in terms of research, because I was very keen to get everything as accurate as I could. But in fact, a lot of people have said that they got just as much feeling for the 18th century when I was describing the tar man's reaction to 21st century London. So that was a curious experience. So that, he was looking at, for instance, at Covent Garden and seeing it through his eyes. So seeing it in his mind, how it was, how it was in 1763. So a bizarre kind of experience, but a very interesting one. But I've just got shelves and shelves of books that I'll have used kind of half paragraph from each, but it's well, if you're a historian, gosh, that's going to be difficult to write. you're going to have to be very select, I think. Are you thinking of writing a historical novel yourself?
I'm playing with the idea. Yeah, I need to finish my dissertation first, but I'm playing with the idea. But I think I'm in grave danger of writing a really boring fictional book, because I do so much research.
Are you writing for children or adults?
I'm considering writing for adults.
Yeah. I think adults are a bit more forgiving in a way, because a lot of adults read historical novels because they are interested in the history, at least. Mm-hmm. But children, they smell it immediately. The writer's trying to feed them stuff. So I think you've got to be quite careful with children, that's for sure.
Yeah. I'm trying to incorporate a little bit of sort of fictional ideas also into my dissertation work now, because I'm, in fact, working on some architecture and a palace complex. And I'm trying to figure out, what was in the garden, what did it smell like. This is obviously things that I shouldn't be doing, but it's interesting.
Oh, why not? That sounds great. I think anything that makes it more real for you. I mean, you can always edit that afterwards, but there'd be some vestige of the fact that the writer thought there was a smell of a rose there.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing your experience with history and the research. That was very interesting to me. So.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Before we wrap up, is there anybody else on the line who I didn't know was on the line who has a final question for Linda? Just checking we've had no extra callers. Okay, well, in that case, thank you so much, Linda. That was a really wonderful experience for me to have the opportunity of asking you so many questions, gleaning so much. And I know that I'm sure Denise and Teresa will agree with me. It's been immensely interesting, and I know that everybody else listening to this afterwards will also enjoy it. So on behalf of everybody, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And I
Thank you.
All right, then. All the best. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.